Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, it is the first episode of 2022. I'm happy to bring you episode 326. This is going to be a preview of the January edition of Retinal Physician, found online at retinalphysician.com. Doctors Akshay Thomas and Marianelli Rodriguez join me for this episode. We discuss a plethora of retina-related topics. We spend some time talking about reimbursement for remote retinal imaging and also about standardization of retinal imaging, some of the challenges that exist today. We then transition, talk briefly about judging epiretinal membranes. Maybe there are better ways to judge which epiretinal membranes to take to surgery, and end with a discussion of wide-field imaging in the context of ocular oncology. Remember that the articles we discuss can be found online at retinalphysician.com. If you check our information, you can see that there are disclosures for all participants and also a link to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes you've listened to in previous years on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Just want to take a minute. This is the first episode of 2022. You know, every time a new year rolls along, it's a good time to take stock and think about things that are important to us, things we want to point out and things we are thankful for. You know, it's obviously been very, very challenging for a lot of people in and out of medicine, ophthalmology, and outside of ophthalmology with COVID, with a lot of the challenges that are in the modern world that don't seem to be going away imminently. And, you know, this was past year was an extremely exciting year for me personally and professionally, but also very up and down year personally and professionally. And, you know, I just want to point out a couple of people. I'm obviously very thankful for all of the people who come in the podcast, take their time to lend their voice, you know, all the participants, there's too many to name, but especially the people who come on for interviews, for the journal clubs, to give their insights on articles like Mari and Akshay are doing today. You want to obviously thanks to our podcast team, Louis Kai, who's actually going to be coming and training with us as a fellow at Bascom Palmer now. Super excited to see kind of everything come full circle for him, and that's what really makes being a mentor so amazing is just seeing the career develop. And Louis really done an amazing job. We're looking forward to having him as a fellow. Mike Vinicasa, Angela Chang, who are in the thick of residency right now. And Mike just got married in November. And Angela, you know, was talking to me about, you know, she and her significant other are purchasing a house. And, you know, just it's amazing how fast time flies. But again, super thankful for the team in my own life. You know, obviously, the most important person in my life is my wife. And super happy we got married last year, and it's just been, you know, wonderful to have her constant support and love. My amazing sisters, Bria and Divya, especially just fantastic in their support, and my mom, Leela. And of course, you know, all the close friends and mentors I've had who've supported, you know, again, through a very tumultuous year for me, very tumultuous year for many of the people out there. So thank you for listening. I know I thank the listeners at the end of each episode, but really thank you for listening. Thank you for the support. Thank you for being a part of this journey with us. And look forward to really spending many more years together, hopefully. For those of you who, again, are interested in learning about other specialties, check out our sister podcast, the American Academy Official Podcast, Experts in Sight. It's gotten full steam. It's been really well received. We've got episodes across specialties. And I've learned a lot doing it. I think people would learn a lot in our field listening to it, staying up to date with cornea and glaucoma and plastics and neuro and all the other great topics that are out there. So thank you for listening. And without further ado, here's the episode.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the January 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. We have arrived at 2022. And no better way to kick it off than talking about four articles from Retinal Physician. Remember, you can find all of these articles online at retinalphysician.com. Joining me for this podcast, first in alphabetical order, Dr. Marianelli Rodriguez from Worcester, Massachusetts. Mari, welcome.
Hi, Jay. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Akshay Thomas from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, how's it going, Jay? Good to see you.
So we got four articles. Again, our goal is not to do exhaustive review. You can read these articles if you find them interesting, but to use them as jumping off points for discussion. The first article we're going to talk about was written by Rodney Fong, Nisarg Mehta, and Glenn Yu from UC Davis. It's titled, Does It Pay? Teleophthalmology for Remote Diabetic Eye Screening. They go into some topics we've talked about before in the podcast about, you know, the prevalence of diabetic retinopathy, how telemedicine could really be helpful in overcoming barriers to screening, and kind of what is the current landscape, as they call it, for billing for remote retinal imaging, and whether or not there's essentially sufficient incentive for this to be put into place. It's important to understand that there's been updates. You know, CMS is constantly changing, and they go through some of the code changes for remote retinal imaging. And there's kind of an interesting discussion about, you know, are these things reimbursed at the appropriate rate? You know, they talk about how the CMS has, you know, recommend kind of called to cut some of these codes slightly, and a lot of the Medicare contractors are setting lower rates for these codes, and the private insurance carriers usually follow suit. And you know, they kind of end with this. I like this article a lot, Mari, and we'll get into discussion just because they end with kind of this thing about, well, this is kind of, again, where we do a lot of times in our healthcare system, where we don't take the short-term pain of maybe paying for preventative service, in this case, a screening, and then we get stuck with a big bill later that we don't see, but it is a big bill for all the problems that come with diabetic retinopathy, not just treatments, but lost work time, people not going to their work to take their family member, surgery time, and of course, the actual blindness that can happen that takes people out of the population and results in them not being able to contribute meaningfully to work and output. Besides, I mean, this is, again, I always feel weird talking about this stuff because I think there's obviously bigger issues than the economic impact of blindness. But if you just really just sat down and didn't care about people and just said, okay, I'm going to tally up my X's and O's, it still makes a lot of sense to prevent blindness rather than let it happen. So, Mari, what do you think of this paper and kind of your thoughts as, you know, we head into 2022 in terms of what we should see in the future for these codes?
Yeah, Jay, this was, I really liked this paper. I thought that it brought up multiple interesting points. You know, the topic of teleophthalmology is such a hot topic right now. You know, the pandemic has really streamlined telemedicine in many professions, but we seem to be lagging a little bit behind. And I think, as you said, there's this huge unmet need in the population out there where only a fraction of diabetic patients are getting the recommended screening. And if we could only increase the number of patients that are getting screenings, you know, we could save a lot of people from going blind from a preventable disease. And, you know, if we could, you know, somehow streamline this so that, I don't know, if the primary care doctors would have, you know, cameras in their offices to, you know, just as they're taking blood pressures, they could also take a picture of the retina, and an AI system could say, you know, send them to the ophthalmologist, send them to the retina specialist. And then we could save a lot of people. But the only way for this to work is if you're going to, you know, pay physicians to do this, because, you know, obviously we live in the real world. You know, we don't live in a vacuum. You know, there is a business that we have to, you know, run. And, you know, if we could think about this from an economic perspective too, I think we could save a lot of vision. And as you said, you know, add a lot of good, you know, value to our society.
Those are great points. And actually, you know, Glenn and his team, one of the things they outlined kind of what they did at Davis, and they go through the hard numbers, right? So they're saying that their average collections per patients using this remote code 92227 was about just under $20. But if they actually looked at the cost of doing the screening, it was about $41 a patient, which is actually not crazy expensive. What's really mismatched there is the amount of money that's being paid per patient. And you know, so this isn't just a case of like retinal physician not willing to take the opportunity cost of doing something that's very lucrative in exchange for something that's less lucrative. They're actually taking a loss. It's really hard to imagine a lot of healthcare systems in today's age surviving that, let alone a standalone retina practice that, you know, or as Mari said, a PCP's office that can't afford to take a $20 loss per patient every time they screen. You know, I always just think, how do you like, what's the way forward with that, right? Because one of the things they talk about later is this AI code. And we can talk a little about that. That's the code that's being fought right now. I'm guessing that CMS doesn't want to increase it because it's quote unquote easy, right? It's like, what's the work involved? You just press a button and the computer does it for you. But, and it's sort of true, but again, as a society, I think sometimes we conflate something being easy with something being less valuable in a weird way. And then if something takes a really long time, we're like, ooh, that was great. It took a really long time, so it must be more worth it. When in medicine, that's usually the opposite.
Right. I mean, you know, I agree with everything you said. I think it's so interesting how, Glenn, they kind of broke down their cost and how they're essentially dependent on various sort of incentive programs to basically kind of make up the difference of what, you know, Medicare reimburses, if at all, right? I think the two situations in which I've seen like these sort of tele-ophthalmology things actually work was one, honestly, like at our VA, right? Like we had, you know, like a really good program where, you know, they got imaging right after their primary care doctor's visit, went to like a VA general ophthalmologist. And if there was something they saw, they automatically got referred to like clinic. So it actually caught a lot of disease early on. This is when we were in the Durham VA. The second would be like part of like what they call these executive health clinics, where they, you know, get a bunch of screenings in addition to their eye screening all the time. And they pay a flat fee for it. You know, so there's some things that are, you know, reimbursed a little bit better, some a little worse, but you kind of average out and everything ends up being covered. But at the moment, as it stands with the reimbursement the way it is right now, I just can't see it, you know, gaining enough traction.
And Mari, I mean, to kind of end this conversation, I think prevention, right, isn't valued enough by us individually or in society, right? The other thing, again, going back to the time argument, I mean, we all have this point of mentality, right? If you, and I know our bodies aren't cars, but if you take your car to the shop and they work on it for 5 minutes and come out and say, hey, that'll be $800, you're gonna be like, what? You didn't do anything. You spent 5 minutes doing that. But if they went in and spent an hour doing the exact same thing because you have no idea what they're doing and came out and said that'll be $500, you might still be like, that's a lot, but you're like, okay, well, at least they worked on it. How do we change that psychology, right? Because like this can be applied to surgery, for example, where cataract surgery has been cut more and more and more. As it became more efficient, it got cut. And like, I can see both sides of the argument. I can see the argument being like, well, you know, you're paying for less of the physician's time. So I guess in a way it makes sense to cut the code. But on the other hand, you're punishing the physician for being more efficient and being better at it, even though they got the same job done, arguably with a safer and more conservative approach than, you know, some of the older techniques like intercaps, for example. So like, I'm just curious, like, I feel like it's really hard for us to accept the idea again, that something that is fast can still be expensive.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really difficult to change that one. And especially because people that are making the decisions at a higher level have no idea about science or anything like that. And you know, as you're saying, you know, they think about it as you're thinking about fixing a car. So, I don't know. That's going to be, it's hard to change this politician's mind. So that's just probably for a different topic.
Let's transition to something maybe we can maybe try to fix. Again, this is maybe going to be, hopefully it's not a depressing podcast to start the year, but these are all separate issues that maybe physicians don't have that much control over. But this is an interesting article. Justin Ma, a shout out to Justin. He does a lot of the video editing for the videos we released on YouTube. Actually, all the video editing, I should say. He's really good at graphic design. He actually did all the images for the book Chirag and I wrote. And so Justin did this year of research up at Duke with Dilraj's former mentors, Sharon Fekrat, and did I call you Dilraj?
I just well, it's okay. I take it as a compliment if you call me Dilraj.
With Akshay's former mentors, Sharon Fekrat and Dilraj Graywall. Shout out Dilraj. So this is an article about standardization of imaging, right? And like this is very interesting. I recommend everyone go and read this. It's just talking about how do we arrive at today, right? Like, if you're a medical student who like arrives in residency and you're like, okay, how do I look at my imaging, right? For all the images we take, how did we arrive here? And it's like, well, we have this vision software for this machine and we have this software for this machine. And well, how do I export those images? Well, these come out as JPEGs and these come out as TIFFs. And like, and where can I see all of these and compare them? Well, you can't actually do that. And then we end up paying for like in-between software to hybrid it and like bring it all together. And it becomes actually very unwieldy and very expensive. never mind the days that the imaging software crashes and then everyone's like, oh my God, we can't actually function in our offices, right? So there's a lot of problems. It's great that we have imaging. It's obviously way better than the days that people talk about where they used to print it out and like put it on the wall and like look at it. It's very similar to radiology, but we don't have standardization, right? And they talk about this DICOM thing. You know, DICOM is this Digital Imaging Communications and Medicine Guidelines. But we don't really have good things that allow us to have kind of this lossless compression of the file. So the tech side, and then sort of the integration side where it's like, hey, I can do all these things to the imaging that I want to. Part of this is that they talk about each device has its own software and it's proprietary and their own thing. It's not dissimilar than EMR to an extent, like where there's not much sharing between the companies because that is their business, right? Is whatever they're producing. So why would they share it with each other? So it's like one of the downsides of capitalism in this case, right? So like, let's bring this back and actually I'll bring you in to talk about this. They talk about things like PACS, like that's been used in radiology and other things that have helped kind of bring this together. Not again to take the conversation in a tone where we both can all conclude that it's not fixable at the end, but you know, how important is this, right? They talk a little bit about AI and we're going to see more AI. Everyone keeps talking about this. If you write AI, it has to be able now to handle every single type of input from all these different softwares. How important is it going to be to kind of get everything on a standard template if we are going to feasibly use algorithms to help us in our clinics?
So short answer is it's going to be critical, right? Because if you have any sort of AI algorithm that legitimately works, you need hundreds of thousands, you know, of images, you know, that you can actually kind of draw from to build these algorithms. And kind of to the point of, you know, of what they've said in this article, you know, you have multiple groups working on multiple different ways and multiple different kind of AI platforms because of the various, you know, imaging software they have available in the data set they're working with, right? So even that is kind of, you know, fragmented all over. So yeah, absolutely the ability to kind of, you know, use one platform to view all these various imaging modalities would be critical.
Mari, how many different imaging software do you use in your practice? Do you have like a unifying software to review all your images? Are you happy with it? Like what is kind of your setup in your clinic? And do you ever open the native, let's say, is there any situation where you open the native device software because you prefer to see it there versus in your main kind of centralized hub?
Yeah, so we do have Forum, which is kind of brings several of the imaging things together, but it doesn't pull the Heidelberg OCTs if we were to take those. So because of that, we kind of mostly use the Cirrus OCTs in our clinic. But for example, if that crashes and then we have to use the Heidelberg, there is just no way to compare the two, and it could be so frustrating in just the day-to-day management of a patient to see, okay, do I extend or do I keep at the same, you know? Just so for like very simple things in our day-to-day practice, it would be wonderful if we could just, you know, put this together. And I probably is gonna cost a lot of money to do something like this anyway. And we're talking about, you know, we always talk about money for some reason and this, like, you know, because it is a business, but, you know, we probably should think about it as a society, how to, you know, I'm talking about the retina field together, how to solve this problem, because, you know, even in our daily practices, it can be impactful.
Yeah. What are your backup systems, Akshay? So like, let's say your main software crashes, like, I feel like it's like we used to call and I have no disclosure for Heidelberg or Zeiss. I love Heidelberg, actually use it for everything. But you know, one of my co-fellows, because the Heidelberg kept crashing and it'd be like super disruptive to clinic, he made a picture of the Hindenburg blimp and superimposed Heidelberg's logo on it, because every time it went down, it was like the worst thing in the world. Like the practice like was in a standstill, right? Like how do you do anything in a retina practice in 2022 if your software doesn't work? Right. Where are your images backed up? Like, do you have a cloud server? Do you have a main server? And what are your backup? What happens in clinic when imaging isn't working?
Yeah, so very similar, Mari, we use Forum, and basically you have these servers which basically like boot every morning and import images from these specific patients that you're going to be seeing, you know, every morning. And there have been multiple times where, for reasons we don't understand, the software isn't working or Forum is down, quote unquote. And honestly, our clinics just come to a standstill. I mean, we have Heidelberg's Spectralis available, but we typically use that just for research. And it's not because of anything other than the fact we can't compare. We have no other patient data in there, right? So even if we got images, we have no comparison. And there's just one machine for, you know, multiple doctors. So pretty much our clinics come to a halt and we're on the phone with tech support trying to figure out what we can do if and when it happens.
Yeah, Jay, and I thought that, you know, it's not only, I mean, we're just talking about, you know, research mm-hmm. and these like big things, but even sharing patients with other doctors. Like, for example, here in Massachusetts, several of my patients, you know, spend 6 months in Massachusetts, 6 months in Florida. I share those patients with doctors down there. And, you know, I have to do the old school printout of the OCT, give right. it to the patient mm-hmm. so that they could take it down there where, you know, if it was radiology, you know, you would give them a CD. They, you know, theoretically, they would take it down there with them or a flash drive.
We don't have CD drives anymore in our computer.
Just like a flash drive, something like that, you know, but, you know, we have to do the printout of the OCT. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it feels like very old school what we're doing.
I mean, there are going to be some students that laugh who are listening to this, or probably residents too. I mean, I remember 3.5-inch floppies, right? Like having to sit there and wait for something to drop on your floppy and hoping like you didn't bend it or break it. Mm-hmm. And now you're right. Like it feels like the problem is because it's protected data. It's like very difficult to encrypt and securely. It can be very expensive. It's not difficult. I actually think it's overpriced, but it's expensive. To like, yeah. It would be great if it was just each patient had their own cloud, right? If they just put it on their mm-hmm. cloud and then they come in, they scan something and then that doctor can pull their images. Because Mari, you talk about that printout, like actually you can relate, like the printout is helpful. It's better than nothing. It's right. still not what you would do in your own clinic. Most of us are quickly scanning through multiple scans. It's the equivalent of giving yeah. a radiologist a single frame from a CAT scan exactly. rather than the whole set. So it's like, and then a lot of times it's like printed as the small edition. Like I get a lot of these MDI notes from other practices. MDI is a great system, but the OCT that comes with it is like pixelated, this small little printout in black and white at the end. And you can just make out contour essentially, but it's not helpful if you're like, is there CME better? Is this better? It's like, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, do I need to inject them today? I actually don't really know. And that's not good care. And we all run into this issue all the time, especially when you have patients that go from practice to practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, in the situations, and there have been a couple of situations where our software has been down, then we basically walk over to the machines and, you know, scroll through the machines to actually look at the volume, because like you said, having a single line scan is essentially useless. Maybe we should all be whipping out our contact lenses and examining right. the fluid, you well, know, with well, the contact
honestly,
lens.
As our patients, I mean, our patients are older, but as they get more tech savvy, I think it's even more helpful just I have my patients just whip out their iPhone and take a video of their last OCT. And then, hey, when you go to your doctor, they just show them this video. Mm-hmm. And that's way more helpful than a printout of their OCT, right? Like, because at least it's dynamic. But even those, like I'll get texts from fellows. Yesterday I had a text from a fellow like with an OCT, and I had to watch it so many times to get the info I wanted because I couldn't stop and like zoom in because it just keeps going. So like there's like things that aren't perfect about it. Well, let's speaking of OCTs, let's transition. We got this next article, when to perform vitrectomy for epiretinal membrane by Kazuaki Kogonosono and Tatsuya Inoue from Japan. Before I talk about the article, show of hands for this audio format. Who had heard of the term Tsukima before this article? Nobody, right? I had never heard of this term. So they talk about predictive factors for predicting whether or not an eye will improve post-peeling, which is really relevant to all of us. The most common procedure we do. We all hate taking patients to surgery for ERM peels, then peeling them, and the patient's like, I don't see any better. In fact, I feel worse because I have a cataract now. And so they talk about things we already know. I mean, we've all heard of DRIL, disorganization of the retinal membrane layers. But then they talk about Tsukima. Tsukima is the term in Japanese for that space between the ERM and the ILM. And I don't know where that term came from because they didn't add a reference and they didn't put a citation. I don't speak Japanese, so I don't know what Tsukima exactly means. Maybe Yoshi Onokawa, if he's listening, can tell us what that means. So I don't know if that just means space or if that's specific to OCT, but it's this space between an ERM and the ILM. And essentially, take home point, if you have large Tsukima, meaning you have a bigger separation, they believe and they posit that you have a better chance of visual improvement than if you have a tight Tsukima and those things are very close together, there's no space. I've never really seen data on this. And it's interesting, they didn't cite any, like, I was looking to find a citation or something. They had a list of citations. They had the one citation from their group back in 2021 that was published in IOBS. So it's like, I haven't read that article, I have to go look at it. And they talk about this term apparently in that paper too, but there's no other series that talks about this. Mari, I mean, I'll be very honest. That has never been factored into my decision-making about whether to take a patient to surgery. And we can talk about some of those things we've talked about before. Had you encountered this before? Is this something you're familiar with?
So I've never been familiar with this particular issue. I mean, yes, it would be, if there is that separation, I could think that it would be easier to peel the membrane because there's already like a potential space. So it could be maybe less disruptive to the actual retina, you know, once you're doing the peel somehow, just to, you know, might be easier to come off. But no, when, you know, as we're talking about, this is an elective procedure. So you want to, you know, have a very frank discussion with the patient about expectations. You know, you want to ask them, you know, the things that we always ask about, metamorphopsia, diplopia, all those things. And, you know, tell them that, you know, try to separate whether, you know, it's a cataract that is causing their symptoms. Is it more the ERM? And then, you know, based on what you just said, I didn't see any data, hard data that they presented that is really going to change the way that I approach this in the future. I think I'm still going to go with, you know, taking one patient at a time and doing my own judgment based on the symptoms of the patient and not really based on something they presented here, which they didn't give me any data for me to really believe that this is an actual, you know, that this is true. I mean, I'm still not convinced. So yeah. I don't think it's going to change my management.
And before I get actually started, just to give some, the data they referenced was a small series of 39 patients with ERM, consecutive patients that went to surgery. And they showed a significant relationship between that space, right? That they call it the Tsukima space. And they defined it based on horizontal and vertical images and a significant relation between that and then their kind of visual acuity improvement. And excuse me, they use more metamorphopsia scores and VA. So both, they found a correlation. That's a very small series. It would be nice to see that validated. Again, Akshay, like my question is, now that you know about Tsukima, and let's say you go read that paper, is this, the real question is, does it change your decision whether to go to surgery? Does it change the conversation with the patient, or does it none of the above?
So as I was reading this, both this article and their manuscript, I had never heard of this before, but I was thinking in my mind about the typical ERM patient I might see and who I might actually operate on. And, you know, the patients that have that, you know, that very like taut kind of ERM, just sticking the retinal surface, it almost tends to be the ones that we see like in some of our, like our DME patients and our vein occlusion patients, and we're wondering like, could this be contributing to why this fluid is not going away? Maybe we should go and peel it. I feel like that's a situation in which we see those more often, and we're already a little bit more hesitant to go in and operate on an ischemic eye, and I tend not to operate on those much. I'd say the average patient that we tend to operate on tends to have more of that corrugated, I get, and with that sort of Tsukima space. So I'll have to look into it. I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I've never really used that as a predictive factor. It just happens to be the patients I operate on tend to kind of have that anatomy now that I think about it. The only patient I can think of like that has like a taut, you know, contour fitting type of ERM would be the ones that also have like the foveal herniation, right? Or like an ectopic fovea that I would consider operating on. But yeah, it's just something I hadn't thought about at all.
Yeah, I got to look at my case. I feel like I have to like go look back at the cases I've done and like think, like this would probably be easy to repeat in a retrospective. I mean, it wouldn't be as valuable as their consecutive series, but I feel like you put together a pretty decent retrospective group of cases. I mean, 36 is nothing. I mean, that's like a surgeon, a busy surgeon in the US does more ERMs in a year.
Yeah.
So like, I just think you could probably come up with a much larger, speaking of imaging, you'd have all those images somewhere and you could go back and measure all of them and look at the visual acuity. You wouldn't have the metamorphopsia scores because we don't usually do that typically in our clinics, but you could get visual acuity results. It's an interesting point, Akshay, whether there's a confounder there, whether like there's just that it's correlation, not causation. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but anyway, I think it's interesting. You should check it out. And then the original article is interesting as well. So let's end by talking about everyone's favorite topic, which is wide field imaging in ocular oncology. Actually, why are you laughing? It's everyone's favorite topic.
I was going to say wide field imaging and uveitis is everyone's favorite topic.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I'll give it to you. That's everyone's second favorite topic. So this is an article from Aaron Singh's group. And they talk, again, things that we won't rehash in this article. They talk about different cameras and then the wide field cameras we have, the big ones, the Claris, and then of course, Optos. And they talk about the value of wide field photos for tracking lesions in the retina and then also wide field FA and how it's really just changed the game. I don't know if there's a ton to add to what they wrote here, being as none of us three do ocular oncology. But just, you know, the only thing that I would say from an ocular oncology standpoint that's interesting that they talk about is sort of this, the color. I mean, they spent a very little time, Mari, talking about limitations of Optos, for example. For onc, I think that's actually relevant, right? Like, I feel a lot, like if I'm asking a friend who's an oncologist to take an eyeball something for me, I feel like a montage, old school montage with a top gun is still way more helpful because they're, it's not like you're looking at diabetic non-perfusion on a black and white FA. You get the color artifact, you get these weird distortions because of the technology. And so something that could be bad could look good and something that it's just very hard to tell because the color is off. I actually think that that's a major limitation. I don't think the photography is nearly as useful as they're talking about. I would still, at least not, maybe I'm old school, I would still rather have kind of a montage if I, all things were equal, if I wanted to take a look and be like, okay, this is what it is. But I don't know how you feel about that. I feel like they sort of glossed over that at the end, but that's probably the most important thing when you start talking about optics. That's like the first question any patient or medical student who doesn't know anything is like, what's that thing? And what's that thing? What's that thing? And they point like six different things on a normal optos. I'm like, well, actually none of that is real. If you look at the second image they took, it disappeared a minute later when they took a different image.
No, I totally agree. We have, in one of the practices that we go to, we have an optos, and in another practice, we have a Claris. And so, yeah, for any lesions that I, you know, nevi or anything like that, that I'm following, I like the Claris so much more because it does have the, you know, preserves the color of the retina. But I agree, you know, you don't see the orange pigment. You don't see if it's brown. You don't see if it has like, you know, I feel like color is so important when you're following these nevi. Even the drusen, you cannot even tell that well, you know, drusen with an optos. So, which is, you know, a positive thing to have with an EVIS. So, yeah, I agree. Optos, the only good thing about Optos is that you could, I guess, just one image for screening if you are in, you know, an optometrist that, you know, doesn't want to dilate a patient. You just take an Optos, looks, you know, but, you know, doesn't look that great. You send it somebody else. But for following these lesions, I think something with more, you know, real color is better.
Yeah, I'm very opinionated when it comes to these cameras. We've had discussions in our group about, you know, which sort of wide field, ultra wide field system to have at various office locations. And, you know, my partner, an ocular oncologist, you know, totally agrees with what you guys said. They prefer having the, you know, true color images and, you know, Claris to kind of monitor lesions, which makes total sense. When you're actually trying to look for margins and measurements in the Optos system where you have to like kind of almost like de-warp all the periphery, you can't really get consistent measurements. I'd say where the Optos shines, whether you're looking at tumors or uveitis or retina, is really in angiography and autofluorescence. You know, the thing to keep in mind, if you've sat behind a Claris or an Optos, the flash from the Claris is pretty terrible. And if you're wanting to get especially peripheral angiographic information, you know, with the Claris, you're going to have to montage, you know, your lates, right? So you're only going to be able to see that periphery in one set of images, whereas with the Optos, you're getting it consistently pretty much across the every single picture you're seeing the periphery. So for me, I think autofluorescence and angiography, the opto system is superior, but for just monitoring of lesion size and color, et cetera, obviously the true color images in a Clara system or equivalent are obviously gonna be superior.
Yeah, there is nothing better than an optos FA. I mean, just from like, I'm just saying, even like from an artist, if you were like going to produce art, like people buy art of like medical images, that's like the best thing out there is just an beautiful optos wide field FA. And like this goes back to our discussion of imaging software, right? Like it's greedy to be like, well, it'd be awesome. Like part of this is the competition, right? Like if those two companies just came together, which would never happen, and like combined something in a software that took the fundest photo with the top candidate, but then when it switches to FA, it could switch out, but it will never exist because they're two separate companies with two separate business models. So it's like the capitalism problem, but not to go into politics, but at least I don't think either would exist in a non-capitalist model either, because it's so expensive to make this stuff. So at least we have these and we're not taking like Polaroids of retina, you know, but yeah, I mean, I think, I just think that you brought up a great point, and just to tie a bow on it, I think we get a lot of screening photos with optos. And I think for screening, if you don't dilate someone, which a lot of patients don't want to be dilated, I do think the optos catches more problems than it quote unquote creates, right? I mean, we all get referrals. We remember and complain to our retina friends about the referrals for the optos referral that was quote unquote dumb. Why did they send this? This doesn't actually anything. It's just something in optos. They all got worked up for nothing. But I mean, it's like a number needed to treat thing. It's like, if you catch a tumor and it like, how many patients need to be optos taking for it to be worth it? I mean, if you're that patient and you have a choroidal melanoma that never would have presented and later would have killed you, like for sure, I'd rather have an optos than an incomplete DFE or like a camera doesn't get out as far. So I agree with Mari. It's like, it's great for screening. It does result in some referrals that maybe don't need to be done, and maybe texts from friends that you're like, that's not actually anything. But that's our job. I mean, that's where we come in. It'd be interesting. Mm-hmm. It goes back to actually your point about AI is like, how would AI mm-hmm. deal with the color artifact? Like right. Would it figure it out or would it get fooled by it? And how would you even fact check it? Like you would probably have to give the AI two different types of photos. You'd have to be like, hey, this is a Topcon. We're telling you this is what it actually looks like in real life. Here's an optos. And we're going to give you enough of these that now you know how to look at an optos and tell what's real and what's not real. But you'd have to actually feed that. Because if you just gave it optos images, how is it going to know what's real or not real? It's going to think everything's real because that's all it's ever known.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly right. And I'm by no means an AI expert, but at least some of the AI gurus I've spoken with, that is a huge issue for them, right? You need kind of consistency in the quality and type of images you're receiving, right? So the way that processes an optos photo versus a montaged, you know, true color photo is going to be very different. So yeah, definitely kind of ties back to what we were talking about with AI earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like if all you knew growing up, Akshay, was, what was that cereal? You call that Cinnamon Toast Crunch?
Oh, man. Yes. I received some heat for that, just so you know, Jay.
Really?
People are like, that's your favorite cereal? Really? Cinnamon Toast Crunch? It's so like a 5-year-old's favorite cereal that just gets like all hopped up on sugar.
I have to say, I'm not making this story up. One of my fellows took me to lunch at our hospital across the street where they have badge access to go to the physician's lounge. I had not been there since before coronavirus started. When I got in there, I looked over and I was super excited because since the last time I got there, they added Cinnamon Toast Crunch to the cereal lineup.
Funny.
And I was so excited. And I was just like, not today because it's lunchtime, but tomorrow I will be back. All right, guys. Thank you again for your time. Have a wonderful holiday season and happy new year to both. Ben, I'll see you. Take care.
Take care, guys.
Same to you. Yeah, happy new year.
Many thanks to Drs. Rodriguez and Thomas for joining me for this episode. As always, you can find this podcast episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 326 episodes there, sorted by category and searchable, dating back to November 2016. You can get updates to the most recent episodes by clicking on the link to subscribe. That will get your email inbox filled with the latest episodes as they release every week. You can find us also on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast. And remember that you can reach us in multiple ways. You can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter or Facebook, reach out there, or you can click on the contact us link on our website. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do. We love getting feedback, so thank you everyone for the feedback you've given us over the years, and gives us ideas of how to get better in the future and continue to provide very meaningful content. Thank you again to our production team, Louis, Mike, Angela. Thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and most importantly, the patients you take care of on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.